At around 11:45 p.m. on April 28th, 2008, a man called 911 to report that his friend had called him about a break-in.
She told me that she woke up and there was someone on top of her and she forced them off and they ran out.
26-year-old Michelle Murphy woke up to a man on top of her. The man was stabbing her, slashing her body, but Michelle fought back.
Do you remember what his clothing was, what he was wearing?
He definitely had a pants and like a long sleeve, like sweatshirt kind of thing.
Do you remember what color the sweatshirt was?
It was a dark color.
Okay, do you remember what color pants?
No.
It's a muffled 911 call. But in it, Michelle tells Santa Monica police dispatchers that a tall man wearing a dark, long-sleeved shirt came into her bedroom through her window. She said he broke the screen. As he repeatedly stabbed her, Michelle managed to pull her legs up to her chest and kick her assailant. This caused him to cut himself with the knife. He began to bleed profusely and ran out of her room, yelling, "I'm sorry.
You're not going to get me. I'm not going to let it happen. This ends here."
Michelle crawled on her hands and knees to open her front door for a police officer who had just arrived. As police worked to track down her assailant, they would learn that this was not his first attack. Another case, this time a woman murdered in a nearby town, had remarkably similar characteristics. And a third woman attacked years before in her Hollywood home also stood out. Then a fourth woman stabbed states away years before.
He watched and waited and collected real-time intelligence on the victims and then manipulated the circumstances to provide himself with the perfect opportunity to pounce and kill in blitz-type knife attacks and then escape detection.
Investigators would learn that they had a serial killer in their midst. He would become known as the Hollywood Ripper. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 89. And now, on to today's episode. This episode contains some graphic testimony. Listener discretion is advised. Four women, all young, all with their whole lives ahead of them, and all attacked with a knife. Three of those women were murdered, but Michelle Murphy managed to escape with her life.
11 years ago, a 26-year-old woman had the strength and courage to fight off a killer. Thanks to her toughness, not only was she able to survive, but she forced her left-handed attacker to cut his right wrist, leaving him bleeding on her bed and leaving a blood trail that took investigators not only back to his apartment, but took investigators to answers that they had been seeking for 15 years.
That's Los Angeles County Prosecutor Garrett Dameron speaking in court about the hunt for the Hollywood Ripper. 3 years before Michelle Murphy was attacked, 32-year-old Maria Bruno was stabbed in her El Monte, California apartment. Her husband, Irving Bruno, called police on December 1st, 2005, saying he found his wife dead. He's distraught on the call, saying that somebody broke into his wife's apartment and killed her. They had recently separated, and Maria had been living on her own for about 2 weeks. Their relationship had reportedly been violent, and Irving was reportedly known to hit her. That night, he said they had gone out to dinner to reconcile and then went back to her place around 2 a.m. to have sex. He left and returned at 7 a.m. to pick her up. When she didn't answer when he knocked at her door, he said he crawled in through an open window.
Tell me what exactly, why would you think that? What did you see?
In the call, he is asked why he thinks his wife is dead. And he says he went in through a window because it was unlocked, came inside, and there was a pool of blood.
And then I went into the window because it was unlocked.
Okay.
And when I came inside, there was a pool of blood.
Police initially focused their investigation on Irving because he was the last known person to be with her. They believed Maria's attacker crawled in through her kitchen window on the first floor of the apartment complex. They found the window screen in a planter box next to the front door. Irving told the dispatcher that he noticed a knife from a box set in the kitchen was missing.
Yes, I'm looking at it right now.
Don't touch anything, Irving.
Maria had been stabbed 17 times. The intruder stabbed her in the neck over and over, then stabbed her in her chest, belly, and arm. One of her breast implants had been carved out of her chest and placed over her mouth. Irving cooperated with police and was eventually ruled out as a suspect. Investigators found a blue surgical booty shoe covering outside of Maria's apartment the morning her body was found. They later came to believe that blue booty belonged to the Hollywood Ripper. 4 years before Maria Bruno was murdered, Ashley Ellerin was a young and popular 22-year-old woman living in Hollywood, California.
Ashley Ellerin led a glamorous life, a beautiful 22-year-old fashion student. She socialized with the young Hollywood crowd.
On February 21st, 2001, Ashley was at home getting ready for a Grammys after party. Then rising actor Ashton Kutcher was supposed to pick her up and she was going to be his date to the party. But when Ashton knocked on Ashley's door that night, she didn't answer. He looked through a window, saw what he assumed was spilled red wine on the floor, and left. He would later learn that was Ashley's blood.
Ashley Ellerin was found stabbed to death in the hallway just outside her bathroom. Ashley had been stabbed over 47 times.
That's Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney Dan Akemin. Akemin spoke to detectives in three different municipalities about striking similarities between the cases in LA County. And while he did, a fourth case was brought to his attention. This case was even older and much farther away. Akemin learned about 18-year-old Trisha Picaccio, who, in 1993, lived in Glenview, Illinois, a suburb outside of Chicago.
Trisha was young, attractive, outgoing, and popular among her classmates. On Friday, the 13th of August in 1993, it was hot and muggy in Glenview, and a thick fog had settled over the area.
Trisha had just graduated from Glenview South High School. She was bound for Purdue University in Indiana, where she had earned an engineering scholarship. Trisha and her friends decided to get together one last time before they would be heading off in different directions to college. On August 13th, 1993, Trisha and her friends spent the evening playing a road rally game, a sort of scavenger hunt. It was a festive gathering.
Trisha's evening ended with hugs and kisses with her friends. To Trisha, it was the summer of her life and the end of a perfect evening with friends.
By 11:30 p.m., they ended up at TGI Fridays. Afterwards, she gave several friends a ride home. She dropped off her last passenger at 1 a.m. Then she drove home, parked her car, and walked up to the side of her house, key in hand, but she never made it inside.
Tricia would never make it to college, and the summer of 1993 would be her last.
A man was waiting for her. He had a knife in his hand. The man, who had an athletic build, grabbed Tricia, snapped her arm, and stabbed her repeatedly in the left breast, arm, and chest. The attacker left her bleeding to death on the doorstep of her family home and then fled. At 9 a.m., Tricia's father, Rick, found Tricia dead on the doorstep. Her body was positioned so that her feet were on the sidewalk and her head was closer to the door. Her car keys were found nearby. Tricia had been stabbed 12 times and had a spiral fracture in her left arm. Detectives worked to solve Tricia's murder, but came up empty-handed. But they did have a primary suspect in mind. He was a friend of her younger brother and lived around the corner from the family house. In 2003, investigators were able to obtain a sample of the suspect's DNA. They tested it against a foreign DNA sample they found under Tricia's fingernails. They had a match. However, the Cook County State's attorney wouldn't press charges against this man. The day before her death, this friend of her brother had given Tricia a ride home in his car. Prosecutors thought the DNA found under her fingernails could have come from casual contact. Frustrated that they were unable to make an arrest, detectives placed the suspect's DNA into a national database. And so this man remained free, and he had already moved across the country, near Hollywood, California. When Michelle Murphy's attacker cut himself, he left a trail of blood in her apartment. Crime scene investigators put a sample of that blood into a national database and had a match. It matched to the suspect in Tricia Picaccio's case. The match was to a man Tricia knew, but Michelle didn't. Detectives went to the suspect's home and immediately realized something rather striking. From standing inside the man's apartment, you could see directly into Michelle's bedroom. The suspect lived across from Michelle's apartment in her complex. Detectives then realized the man had been watching Michelle, waiting and stalking until he saw the right opportunity to attack. When he saw she was home alone and had left her window cracked open to let a breeze in, he pounced. Nearly 3 months after Michelle's attack, Santa Monica police arrested Michael Gargiulo for the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy. Michael said something odd when he was arrested. He asked, "Which agency is this?" On September 4th, 2008, Michael Gargiulo was indicted on two additional charges, the murders of Ashley Ellerin and Maria Bruno. In 2011, the CBS TV show 48 Hours ran a special on Michael Gargiulo and the unsolved murder of Tricia Picaccio. A friend of Michael's who worked with him as a bouncer at the Rainbow Room in Hollywood saw that TV special and told a story to the 48 Hours correspondent, a story he would later repeat to police. Teamer Leary called his other buddy, Anthony DiLorenzo, and they recalled a time they were cruising down Sunset Boulevard with Michael. Anthony says Michael asked them, "You guys ever kill anybody? I have." They laughed at him and told him to shut up, but Michael kept going. He told them, "Yeah, I buried a bitch. I left the bitch on the steps for dead." This was the break in the case prosecutors needed. On July 7th, 2011, the Cook County State's Attorney charged Michael Gargiulo with the first-degree murder of Tricia Picaccio. Michael sat in the Los Angeles County Jail for years awaiting trial. There were nearly 100 pre-trial hearings in his case. He fired attorneys and even tried to represent himself. He was also accused of attempting to escape jail. He had been in jail longer than any other inmate awaiting trial in the history of the LA County Jail. Finally, he settled on his legal team, composed of high-powered, court-appointed defense attorneys. And on May 2, 2019, Michael Gargiulo finally went to trial.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, and ladies and gentlemen of the jury. The methodical and systematic slaughter of women by Michael Gargiulo, the boy next door killer. That's what this case is about. What you will hear is that Michael Gargiulo, for almost 15 years, was watching. Always watching.
Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney Dan Akemin was the lead prosecutor on the case. He said Michael Gargiulo's hobby was plotting to kill women in and around their homes.
What you will hear is that Trisha Picaccio, Ashley Ellerin, Michelle Murphy, and Maria Bruno were all young, attractive, and outgoing. What these women also had in common was they all lived near Gargiulo. He had targeted them for murder, and he ultimately attacked all of them with a knife.
He said Michael grew up as a neighbor kid in Chicago. He was an athlete, a boxer, and played on his high school's football team. Then he later in life worked as an air conditioning repairman and eventually owned his own business. He was a husband and a father.
What no one knew for many years, however, was that Michael Gargiulo was leading a double life. Gargiulo, who fancied himself as an expert in forensic science, attacked four women with a knife, killing three of them, and then was able to escape detection for almost 15 years.
Akemin asked, how did Michael Gargiulo plan the attacks?
The evidence will show that Gargiulo's plan to kill was to first identify a target who lived near him, acquaint himself with that victim and her habits and routines, and then watch, shadow, stalk, and hunt down the victims relentlessly as part of his plan to kill.
According to Akemin, the same man who murdered Trisha also murdered Maria and Ashley and attempted to kill Michelle. The attacker was a serial sexual thrill killer. He was the Hollywood Ripper. Defense attorney Daniel Nardoni walked up to the jury and spoke with them directly. He said under the law, Michael Gargiulo is presumed innocent. He reminded them that what prosecutors, as well as himself, says in opening statements, isn't evidence. He urged them to listen to the evidence before making their decision. The burden of proof lies with the government, he said. The prosecution started with its strongest case and most powerful witness.
Michelle Murphy, because of her strength and courage, allowed investigators to work backwards and piece this entire case together. Michelle Murphy was the very first witness who testified in this trial. She was also the last woman Michael Gargiulo was able to victimize. This case literally begins and ends with Michelle Murphy.
Michelle Murphy, now 37, took the witness stand to confront her alleged attacker. She described Monday, April 28th, 2008, as what seemed like a typical day. She ran errands in the evening, then showered, ate dinner, and watched TV. Her roommate was out of town at the time, and so she had the apartment to herself. She went to bed around 10:30 p.m. That's when she describes waking up about an hour later to a man in her room. "I woke up with someone on top of me, stabbing my arm," she told the jury. "I could tell it was a knife. I grabbed at the knife with both hands. I wrapped my hands around the blade. I was trying to hold the knife and get some leverage to stop him from stabbing me. I was still being stabbed. I was just trying to wiggle around to keep from getting hit." Michelle struggled with her attacker, grabbing the knife and pulling her legs up to kick him. She screamed over and over, asking why he was doing this. But the man didn't respond. Blood covered her comforter. It spattered her sheets, pillowcases, and bedroom walls. Finally, she was able to knock him to the floor.
After she fought with Mr. Gargiulo, he ran. He ran towards the front of the house. He yelled, "I'm sorry." He ran out the house. She ran behind him, locked the door, and then went back and called the police at that point.
Officer Steve Spencer from the Santa Monica Police Department came to Michelle's door first. She was on her hands and knees, bleeding, leaving bloody handprints in her hallway. He said blood trailed throughout her apartment, from the bedroom to the front door. It was a bloodbath. The same blood trail continued outside and crossed the alleyway of her apartment complex. It led right to Michael Gargiulo's apartment. He had then gotten into his van and fled. Investigators collected samples for testing. Spots in Michelle's bedroom tested positive for Michelle's and Michael's DNA. Spots outside her apartment door, down the walkway, and alley past Michael's apartment matched to Michael. A sheriff's office DNA expert said spots on Michelle's comforter were a 1 in 1 trillion match to Michael.
Basically, you would have to go through a trillion people before you came across another person with that DNA profile. 1 in 1 trillion.
Because of the attack, Michelle had to get stitches on 8 parts of her right arm. She also has permanent nerve damage in her hand. Prosecutors then moved on to their next most recent victim, Maria Bruno. In November 2005, Maria moved into the Arden Way apartment complex while in the process of separating from her husband, Irving. They had 4 children together. Their relationship had been violent, and Irving had reportedly been known to beat Maria. In court, several people who lived there said they would see Michael Gargiulo on the landing outside of his apartment door, staring into Maria's unit. One of the tenants, Robert Rasmussen, said he saw the same man from the landing looking through her window and trying her door handle. He said he later saw that same man follow Maria into her apartment. He watched as the man backed out with his palms up, indicating he was not welcome inside. According to prosecutors, at 5 p.m. on November 30th, 2005, Irving and Maria went out on a date. They were trying to patch things up. While at the restaurant, Maria cut herself and bled inside Irving's car. At 2 a.m., Maria and Irving came back to Maria's apartment after a night of drinking and had sex. At 2:45 a.m., Irving left Maria's apartment. As he left, a man crept in through her window.
The evidence will show that on December 1st, 2005, Gargiulo entered Maria's apartment through a window, put on blue surgical booties, and mutilated Maria with a knife as she slept. The evidence will show that Gargiulo slashed and stabbed Maria multiple times and gashed out her throat. He cut off her breasts, attempted to remove her breast implants, and placed one of her breasts in her mouth.
He said at 7:40 a.m., Irving returned to Maria's apartment to return her cell phone and to take her to pick up her car so she could get to work. There was no answer when he knocked on the door. As he turned to leave, he noticed the window screen had been knocked on the ground, so he climbed into Maria's window to wake her up and instead found her dead. He called 911 and police officers arrived minutes later. Investigators found that blue surgical booty shoe covering outside of Maria's apartment the morning her body was found.
That booty was tested for Ms. Bruno's blood DNA, and it does have her DNA on it. It has her blood on it. The criminalist also tested the elastic band around that blue booty, and it was a match to Mr. Gargiulo to the tune of 1 in 25,644.
After Michael's arrest in Michelle's case, investigators secured a warrant to search his apartment. They found a blue booty that is the same make and brand of the one found in front of Maria's apartment. Michael's attorneys say this is not enough evidence to prove he murdered Maria. They pointed to another suspect, one they claim was there at the time she was murdered and has a stronger motive.
The marriage of Irving and Maria Bruno was fractured. And how do we know? Why do I say this? It's based upon the evidence, naturally. It goes without saying. Sadly, Maria Bruno was a victim of domestic violence, and she suffered domestic violence at the hands of her husband, Irving Bruno.
Detective Mark Lilienfeld interviewed Irving for 4 hours. Irving admitted to striking his wife for 9 years. He said that on the night of the murder, he threw Maria to the ground and punched her in the face. Irving had a history of blacking out when he drank alcohol. When Detective Lilienfeld asked Irving if he was responsible for the stab wounds, Irving said maybe he blacked out.
I think it says volumes of what lack of respect he has for his wife. Aside from the brutality that his wife endured.
Robert Rasmussen said the person he saw go into Maria's apartment and then retreat with his hands up was not a tenant in the complex. In June 2010, Robert Rasmussen did not identify Michael Gargiulo in court at a preliminary hearing. He didn't identify him in 2019 either.
Photographs were shown of the tenant, not him. He made no photographic identification. But the most important thing, it was not a tenant. It was not a tenant. Well, Michael Gargiulo was a tenant. It was not him.
No witnesses ever saw Michael Gargiulo go into or out of her apartment. Then the defense pointed to a neighbor who lived in the unit directly above Maria, who testified that she woke up at around 1:30 a.m. to the sound of crying.
She heard crying at 1:30 in the morning. Keep in mind, she's sound asleep. She hears this crying. She lives above. Where do you think it's coming from? And who's down there at 1:30 in the morning? You know who. Irving Bruno.
A criminalist lifted 17 fingerprints from Maria's apartment. 4 of them matched Maria. None matched Michael. 2 hair samples were also collected from Maria's apartment. The first matched Maria. The second was not similar to either Maria or Michael. Defense attorney Daniel Nardoni pointed out that there was no DNA found on Maria's body that matched to Michael either. But drops of Maria's blood were found in Irving's car. Nardoni claimed the murderer in this case didn't come armed with a knife. The murder weapon was believed to have come from a knife pack of three that was found in Maria's home. One was missing.
I think it's reasonable to conclude that that was the murder weapon, that the murderer who came to the house, who came inside the house, opened that kitchen drawer, took out the knife packet, opened up the packet, and stabbed his wife. Stabbed his wife. The person that did this, stabbing her multiple times, cutting off her breasts and stabbing her, what's it tell you? I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. And then pulling out the implants. Whoever did this made it personal.
Before Michael lived in Maria's Arden Way apartment complex in El Monte, he lived in Hollywood, where the murder of Ashley Ellerin occurred. In 2001, Michael moved from Illinois to the Hollywood Hills. He happened to live in a home right near Ashley Ellerin.
Ashley was very social and outgoing and soon attracted Gargiulo's attention. Gargiulo, who lived within a short distance from Ashley's house and frequented the dog park across from her house, injected himself into Ashley's life. He initially approached Ashley and friends and offered to change a tire for them. Eventually, he gained access to Ashley's home by offering to fix the furnace in the basement. Then he began showing up at Ashley's house unannounced and uninvited. On one occasion, one of Ashley's friends saw Gargiulo staring into Ashley's house at odd hours, surveilling her home.
Another time, Ashley's friends remember Michael crashed a party at her house and fixated on her. They wondered who he was, why he was there, and why he was fixated on Ashley. On a separate occasion, Michael let himself into her home with a key he somehow had and scared Ashley and her friend.
Gargiulo's actions were so disturbing to Ashley's friends that Ashley's roommate concluded that Gargiulo was stalking Ashley and she should be concerned. On one occasion, Gargiulo appeared at the house unannounced and looking for Ashley. Her roommate answered the door and told Gargiulo that she was not at home. During the ensuing conversation, Gargiulo told the roommate that the FBI was after him for a murder they said he committed in Chicago. During their conversation, Gargiulo showed the roommate a knife he had concealed in a sheath on his ankle.
Ashley believed her home was secure. It was an older style bungalow, but there were burglar bars on the windows and a popular dog park across the street. On February 21st, 2001, Ashley dropped her father off at the airport around 5 p.m. At 7 p.m., she invited a man named Mark Durbin over. Mark managed her rental home. The two had sex, and he left. Earlier in the afternoon, Ashton Kutcher called Ashley from the set of That 70s Show, where he had just finished rehearsing. He described in court calling her later in the evening to confirm their plans to go out that night. He said they spoke at 8:24 p.m. He told her that he was running late, and she told him that she had just gotten out of the shower. Ashton recalled telling her, "I'll see you later." And that was it. At around 8:30 p.m., Ashley's neighbor, Todd Jackson, was walking his dog in the park, and he heard screaming coming from Ashley's house. He said in court that his dog alerted to the house twice. Between 9 and 9:20 p.m., Mark Durbin called Ashley 2 to 3 times, but got no answer. And at 10 p.m., Ashley's friend Justin called her with no answer. Ashton Kutcher described in court continuing to call Ashley with no answer. "I was trying to take her on a date, and I didn't want to sound overeager, so I just left her a message," he said. He said he went to her house anyway, sometime between 10:30 and 10:45. Quote, "I knocked on the door and there was no answer. I knocked again, and once again, no answer. At this point, I pretty well assumed she had left for the night and that I was late and she was upset. I thought it odd that the lights were all on. I didn't want to be the guy looking through her window. Then I saw what I thought was red wine on the carpet. I remember the next day after I heard about what happened, I went to the detectives and said, my fingerprints are on the door. I was freaking out." We now know that red staining on her carpet was blood, and Ashley had been murdered.
Mr. Kutcher is part of the chronology of this case that is offered to show you that there was a narrow, very narrow window of opportunity for somebody to get into the house and murder Ashley. The evidence will show that Gargiulo attacked Ashley from behind, cutting her throat from right to left, nearly decapitating her, and indicating an attack from a left-handed perpetrator. Gargiulo is left-handed.
Crime scene analysts found blood drops and bloody shoe prints in Ashley's home heading out her door. The blood drops were to the left of the shoe prints, suggesting the murderer held the weapon in their left hand. According to the medical examiner, Dr. Pedro Ortiz, one of the cuts on Ashley's neck was from right to left, which also indicates a left-handed attacker. Dr. Ortiz described significant force injuries she had to her head, and she had additional stab wounds to her back, kidney, neck, chest, abdomen, under her breast, leg, and hands, which appeared to be defensive wounds. Investigators noted the wound to her clavicle was done in the same manner that was mentioned in the Anarchist Cookbook, which instructs its readers how to hold a knife, how to grip it, and how to maneuver it. A woman named Suzanne, who used to date Michael Gargiulo, testified that he used to read that book. Under cross-examination, she was asked by the defense, "Did Michael tell you anything about this book?" She said he did. She said he told her, "Yeah, it shows you how to kill people." But again, the defense cited a lack of evidence and tried to point the finger at someone else in Ashley's killing, too.
There's not one single witness called by the prosecution that saw Michael Gargiulo go into the house on the evening of November 21st or leave the house on the evening of November 21st. And better yet, there's not one single witness to have seen him in the area of November the 21st, the evening hours of 8:30 or there on, or even prior to 8:30 on November the 21st. Okay, so what we have up to this point, ladies and gentlemen, is that there are no eyewitnesses. Let's look to the forensic evidence. Let's look to see what physical evidence that connects Michael Gargiulo with the Ashley Ellerman murder. Make sense? Is there physical evidence connecting Mr. Gargiulo to the murder? And the answer is none. There is none.
Detective Small called in the cavalry in an attempt to find evidence to lead to the suspect. There was no DNA at the crime scene that positively ID'd Michael Gargiulo. The team obtained 28 fingerprints from inside the home. None matched Michael Gargiulo. They swabbed Ashley's body for DNA. No match to Michael Gargiulo.
There was a bloody shoe print on the wooden landing where Miss Ellerman was. And there's blood all over, as you know, There was a bloodied shoe print on the Berber carpeting. And that's all in the exhibits. You'll see that the bloodied shoe print appears to have been made by a tennis shoe of some sort because of the pattern, that's the distinctive pattern. You know, we heard a hell of a lot of evidence regarding the booty or the booties in this case. We know at the time of 2001, Mr. Gargiulo worked as an air conditioning furnace man and wore booties. We learned that from Gus Bone, who was his partner and he worked with. Remember him? And so the point being, we have this horrific crime. We have bloodied shoe prints from a tennis shoe, but certainly there are no booty prints or nothing resembling a booty, for that matter.
The defense said the most important witnesses in Ashley's case were Ashton Kutcher, Todd Jackson, and Mark Durbin.
I believe Ashton Kutcher is the star witness in this case.
Ashton was supposed to pick her up at 8, but called her at 8:24 to say he was running late. What happened during that conversation? Nardone asked. Ashley stated she just got out of the shower. As I said earlier, Todd Jackson lived down the street at a nearby apartment complex. Around 8:30, he took his dog for a walk. While at the dog park across from Ashley's home, he heard two screams from a woman. The screams were so loud, his dog Gretel was alerting and tugging on the leash in the direction of Ashley's house.
Todd Jackson saying he heard screams. Mark Durbin testified that he went over to the house, and while he was there, Ashley Ellerman was taking a shower. After she got out of the shower, she got on the phone, and she was talking to someone. Who do you think she was talking to? Mr. Kutcher.
While Mark Durbin was testifying, defense attorney Dale Rubin asked him if he killed Ashley. He said, no, I did not. Mark said he was just hanging out with Ashley that night from about 7 p.m. till 8 p.m. He said Ashley took a shower while he was still there, and then they were physical. I don't remember if I kissed her first or if she kissed me, but it was a mutual thing, he said. He said they made love for about 15 minutes, and then he left Ashley's because he was expecting his own girlfriend to arrive at his nearby apartment. Michael's defense implied that Mark was there when Ashley was killed.
This guy, Mark Durbin, says he went over there about 7 p.m. with the intent to have sex. He says he was there for about an hour and a half before he left to go down to the Bonita Apartments. He says he was there when Ashley was showering, as I mentioned. He was there when she got the phone call, Mr. Kutcher. Well, you know what? He's also there when Todd Jackson hears the screams coming from the yellow house. Look at the time. I'm not going to beat around the bush with you. I think there's suspicion that Mr. Durbin did this murder.
Mark had testified that he went home, showered, and took out the trash. The defense questioned Detective Small about that trash, but it had already been picked up. The detectives had also apparently noticed a fresh scratch on Mark's arm. Ashley's roommate, Jennifer, said Mark has a dark personality and is weird.
It should be evident to you that the prosecution failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Michael Gargiulo murdered Ashley Ellerman.
The prosecution was able to get information about Trisha's murder in for evidentiary purposes. The jurors would not be asked about guilt or innocence, since that case will be tried in Illinois court. Prosecutors told the jury about that 1997 conversation Michael allegedly had with his two bouncer buddies. And they also brought another one of his former friends to the stand, Mirko Hoffman. Mirko said he met Michael at a Hollywood gym in 1999. He said Michael liked talking about the murder of a woman who had lived close to him. Michael would tell him that she was attractive and that her head got cut off. Mirko said Michael was also interested in forensic science. He said if he ever committed a crime, he would get away with it, he testified. He said Michael was a fan of the TV show America's Most Wanted because, quote, he would learn lessons from other criminals who got caught. Michael's plan, according to Mirko, lie until you die. That's what he said would be his plan if he ever got caught doing anything, he said. On cross, the defense sought to discredit Mirko by getting him to admit that he had researched the case extensively online. Mirko insisted he called police as soon as he learned about Michael's arrest, but conceded that he does dislike him. Prosecutors also presented evidence from a sting operation they conducted while Michael was in jail after his arrest.
After Mr. Gargiulo was arrested, he was taken to the El Monte jail. And this is a photograph of the El Monte jail here. This was done in an operation with two undercover detectives that you're going to hear from. They'll testify probably in June. Detective Michael Staley and Detective Dana Duncan, both undercover detectives for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. They look like regular guys, they're not in uniform. They put those two detectives in this jail cell with Mr. Gargiulo for about 40 hours, and they chatted away, and it was recorded.
This technique, known as a Perkins operation, involves an undercover detective posing as an inmate. Prosecutors played the audio in court, but I'm not going to play it here because there's a lot of echoing, having been recorded in a jail cell. In the recording, Michael can be heard asking his cellmates, "This is my question with the detectives. If I was there, where are my shoes that made the print? Where are my clothes that I wore? Where is the knife? Where is the eyewitness?" Neither the knife nor the bloody clothing were ever recovered. Michael and the undercover detective then start talking about whether or not police searched dumpsters in all different towns. Michael then asks, "If it was your tale, how would you explain it to the jury?" He says, "Man, I'm fucked. Shit. Ugh." The detective responds, "Yeah, no shit, dude." Michael asks, "If you were in my situation, how do you explain that shoe cover?" "How do you explain what?" the detective asks. "That shoe cover to a jury?" Michael asks. At one point, Michael slips out of view of a security camera while in his cell, flushes the toilet, and comes up behind the undercover detective to demonstrate coming up from behind someone and stabbing at the throat. In that same operation, Michael starts talking about how to escape. He asks, "How many people are down there, down that way, on the way out, like cops? Man, if we overtook them, we could get out. If we overtook them when they opened the door, you know?" He talks about slamming the cops down, grabbing their stun guns from them, and putting them in cuffs. After this, the detectives had to terminate the operation because they believed Michael was about to follow through with his plan.
At the end of this, the detectives terminated the operation because they believed that Mr. Gargiulo was going to attack a female jailer and go ahead with this plan. So they stopped the operation at that point. When they did a further investigation and pulled Mr. Gargiulo out of the jail cell, these are the pants that he was wearing, the jail pants that he was wearing. They looked inside the waistband and they found these two pieces of plastic. And that's a close-up view of those. The detectives will tell you that these are the pieces of plastic that Mr. Gargiulo was making to try to turn them into handcuff keys, or what they call in jail terms, a shim.
Detectives believe Michael planned to escape and flee to Mexico. He was charged with an additional count of attempting to escape. In a not-so-typical move, prosecutors had the jury leave court and go to each of the three victims' homes in Los Angeles County to see the proximity of where they lived to Michael.
In the end, ladies and gentlemen, the evidence will show that there are a combination of similar factors among all four of these attacks. All of the victims were young, outgoing women. All of the attacks occurred at night. All of the victims suffered multiple stab wounds. All of the victims were stabbed with a knife. Each of the victims was attacked in or around her home and in close proximity to Mr. Gargiulo, where he was able to actually follow their movements and see into their homes.
The defense also had their turn to present a case. Neuropsychologist Deborah Budding met with Michael and told the jury he was in special education for most of primary school due to behavioral issues. She read from an intelligence report on Michael's capabilities as a child that said he tended to be angry and engaged in power struggles with adults. She said he may have had signs of conduct disorder. The defense also called a psychologist who interviewed Michael several times at the jail to the stand. She diagnosed him with dissociative identity disorder, a diagnosis that did not sit well with him. He did not believe he had a mental illness, she testified. He was upset that I was pursuing this. He said I was a liar. He was adamant about that. Clinical psychologist Dr. Robert Shug said he believes Michael meets the criteria for antisocial personality disorder. He testified that Michael has patterns of impulsivity manifested by a failure to plan ahead and decisions made at the spur of the moment without forethought for considerations of the consequences. But Dr. Shug said he did not find any other evidence of mental disease or defect and believes he does not qualify for legal insanity. Attorney Dale Rubin told the jury that their experts have diagnosed Michael with a mental disease or disorder. Why does that matter? He said Michael can't premeditate. He can't deliberate. He can't have malice aforethought. He said the prosecution hasn't met their burden of proof. However, he did then concede to the prosecution's strongest case. He said Michael did attack Michelle Murphy.
We look at the testimony of Michelle Murphy, who said, and I admit she went through a terrible experience. If we could make it not happen, we would have. But the bottom line is she says that she's fighting off Mr. Gargiulo when all of a sudden he cuts himself. He stands up. He like comes out of a fog. He stands up, looks around, says, I'm sorry, and runs out. This is an individual who just came to from a dissociative fugue. Didn't know where he was, didn't know what he was doing, has no recollection and no memory of what happened because he was in an amnesiac state.
The defense told the jury that Michael is presumed innocent and that presumption remains until the government can prove that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
There's a variety of ways you can go. You can convict Mr. Gargiulo on all these crimes. You can find him not guilty on all these crimes. Or you can find him guilty of some crimes and not guilty of other crimes. And we know that the evidence in this is stronger. Is much stronger at this point. And I'm referring to Michelle Murphy. That's the elephant in the courtroom, I guess. But the evidence is stronger. What's critical, and this is why I asked you, this is why the defense asked you to sit here today in this trial, that proof of one offense carries with it no inference or assumption that the accused is guilty of the others.
He asked the jury to judge each case separately to decide if the prosecution met their burden. He said he feels the evidence doesn't raise to that level in Ashley's and Maria's cases. Prosecutors had one last chance to address the jury, rebutting the defense's claims.
What we know is that defendant Michael Gargiulo is sophisticated, he's sadistic, he's a stone-cold serial killer who preys on women and will do anything to get away with murder.
According to prosecutor Dan Akemin, the same man who murdered Trisha also murdered Maria and Ashley and attempted to murder Michelle. The attacker was a serial sexual thrill killer. The attacker was the Hollywood Ripper. And Michael Gargiulo was the Hollywood Ripper. The jury had four options to consider: guilty of all charges, guilty of some but not all, guilty but insane, or not guilty. After 4 days of deliberations, the jury reached their verdict: guilty of the murder of Ashley Ellerin, guilty of the murder of Maria Bruno, guilty of the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy, and guilty of attempting to escape custody. The case then went to a sanity phase, but that same jury decided that Michael was not criminally insane. And so for a third time, the jurors gathered again, this time to decide his sentence: life in prison or the death penalty. Prosecutors told the jury they wanted the death penalty, but Dale Rubin, one of Michael's attorneys, said that it's a given that Michael will die in prison. The question is when, he said. Is it going to be in God's time, or is it going to be in your time? He then told the jury that Michael suffers from mental illness, that even the prosecutor called him a psychopath and said he's psychotic. These are mental issues, he said, and in this country, we don't execute the mentally ill. Michael's 16-year-old son also told the jury that he did not want his father to be executed. The jury recommended the death penalty, although there's currently a moratorium on executions in California. Michael will soon be extradited back to Illinois to face a charge of first-degree murder for the death of Trisha Picaccio. If convicted there, he will face a sentence of 25 years to life in prison. Prosecutors have long suspected these four women are not the only victims of the Hollywood Ripper. Investigators believe there could be as many as 11 victims of Michael Gargiulo. While these four cases might finally be closed, more remain open. And that's all for this episode. Let me know your thoughts on this case. Do you agree with the verdicts and sentencing? Do you think Michael is mentally ill? Let me know by joining the discussion on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. If you'd like to hear these episodes ad-free, check out my Patreon options at courtjunkie.com/support. Not only can you get these episodes ad-free, but I also put up bonus episodes each month for the $6 and $10 a month tiers. I just published a bonus episode about the Julie Harper case, a wife and mother who was accused of murdering her husband in Carlsbad, California. I found that case particularly interesting because there was a change in California law that threatened to change a very major part of that case. So to sign up for monthly bonus episodes or to just get access to these episodes ad-free, go to courtjunkie.com/support. I'll also be adding new content at the $10 level starting next month, so be on the lookout for that. Today's episode was researched and written by Jennifer Tintner from the Law and Crime Network. You can follow her on Twitter at Jennifer Tintner. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.